This meeting is now being recorded.
Thanks, everyone. Revenue distribution training for December 2017 is now getting underway. My name is Andy Liebenbaum. You will see the training agenda we have today. I'll do a little bit of welcoming. I'll introduce our faculty for the day. We'll take care of a few housekeeping items, training expectations and goals. I'm going to start the day with my favorite little housekeeping item, and that is if you want to talk in the background amongst yourselves, please use the mute button. Don't use the hold button, but be sure to use the mute button. Yesterday, we heard some fascinating conversations that I don't believe we were supposed to hear. So I would just encourage you to keep your phones on mute unless there's something very important you need to share with us. We're going to be including conversations today about the Franchise Tax Board. The State Comptroller's Office is going to give us an update. My colleagues at the Judicial Council and I will also be giving you updates on information. We actually already have dates for the in-person meetings coming up in May, so we will be sharing that with you at the end of the call. And then, of course, for those of you who want and need your training certificates, we'll make sure that you can get that. Let me start by introducing our faculty with the Franchise Tax Board. You'll get to hear from in a few minutes Jennifer Jacobson and Kasia Kilgore from the Franchise Tax Board. From the State Comptroller's Office, you're going to hear from Don Lowry. Jim is unable to meet us today. But Lisa Denise is also here, and she's going to talk about some audit findings I think you'll find interesting. From the Judicial Council, my friend and colleague Kim DeSilva is going to be talking about the uniform bail and penalty schedules. Maria Lira, whom I think most of you know, will be presenting, as well as a new person in our Funds and Revenues Unit, Manny Mandipat. And then I will be talking about some legislative updates. Housekeeping information. This one's going to look familiar. Please place your phones on mute. And followed closely by our second favorite, please don't place us on hold. While the music is fantastic, it sometimes interferes with our presentations. If you have questions, please use the WebEx chat feature that you can see to the right of your screen. Please send your questions to Maria Lira. We will get those questions. If we can answer them during today's conversation, we will. If we cannot, we will get back to you. So when you submit questions to us, please include your name and contact information. In fact, we'd like you not only to send the questions through the chat feature, but also through the State Comptroller's Office Local Gov Policy at sco.ca.gov. and through revenue distribution at jud.ca.gov. There will be pauses between the major sections when we're presenting today, plus we'll have a 5-minute break at about the halfway point. So there will be time for you to submit questions to us. And again, if we can get to them today, if we can provide you answers, we will. If we can't, we will certainly get back to you. We just need to know how to get back to you. In terms of the evaluation questionnaire, you're going to receive a SurveyMonkey survey probably in the next couple of days. We'd like to have your feedback returned to us by the 22nd of December. That is critical information. It makes these trainings pertinent to you. We want to be responsive to your needs. We want to know what kind of information is helpful for you in your jobs. So please provide that feedback to us. The PowerPoint and this audio will be posted by Friday of next week, December 15th. You'll be able to use this link that you see on the screen. And then for those of you who would like a training completion certificate today, today's training is worth 2 hours. Keep in mind that if you are not registered, if you're hanging out in somebody's office listening to this presentation but you have not registered, you will not be able to get a training certificate. Only people who are individually registered will be able to. So please go ahead and register at revenuedistribution@jud.ca.gov so that we can send that training completion certificate to you. Our training goals today, we want to provide an overview of the FTB's collections programs. You've heard them before, but it's super helpful information. We're very glad that we've got our team here to present today. We're going to talk about some changes and updates to the trial court revenue distribution guidelines. We want to provide you an overview of audit findings related to distribution. We're going to identify the changes to the uniform bail and penalty schedules that will become effective on the 1st of January. We'll do a little bit of legislative update information. We also want to present you some information updates on collections and revenue distribution, and then most importantly, give you the dates for the spring 2018 training. Now, many of you have probably been in revenue collections and distributions for some time, and so I think that the chart will make sense to you. You know that for civil traffic and criminal violations, there is assessment and collection, calculations and distribution and recipients. What you may not know is how complicated the actual distribution is. So once that money comes in, this slide is our shock and awe slide. It's designed to show you just how complicated and convoluted the distribution process is. It is a reminder to all of us about how valuable you are and how important the work you do is to the state of California. These 37 buckets are just an example of how complicated each distribution for every fine is. Now I would like to introduce our friends at the California Franchise Tax Board who are going to give you an overview. I'm going to introduce first Jennifer, and then she'll introduce Kasia. So will our FTB friends take it away?
Well, good afternoon. This is Jennifer. We're happy to be here today. My name is Jennifer Jacobson. I'm sorry. I am a supervisor for the Quarter Debt Collections Program. I'm going to give an overview of the Quarter Debt Collections Program, but first I'd like to remind you that the information shared today is the same information that was shared in San Diego and in Sacramento training, with the exception of the revenue amounts collected. So over the next 10 minutes, I will cover the following: background and funding, program eligibility and enrollment, how the program works, online services, program statistics, and the support we offer your program. So let's talk about background and funding. The Quarter Debt Collections Program started out as a pilot program in 1994. In 2004, the program was made permanent by the legislature and has expanded statewide to assist the courts in their collection efforts. Today, we currently have 39 courts and 44 agencies participating in the Franchise Tax Board Quarter Debt Collections Program. So now let's talk about funding. Funding is provided by the participating clients. Quarter Debt Collections charges 15% of what we collect. If our operating costs are lower at the end of the year, we will reimburse you the difference. So who gets to participate and how do you do it? State agencies can refer any types of restitution orders and fines imposed by juvenile or superior courts. Courts can refer any type of fines, penalties, bail, and forfeitures. So let's talk about enrollment. We make it easy for you to enroll. You can call our Quarter Debt Collection Client Services hotline, or you can email us. Once we are in contact with you, we will send you information about the program. We'll send you a 3-year Memorandum of Understanding, MOU, to sign and get started, and we'll provide you training. And once you're ready, we will begin to test your files for a smooth transmission of cases. So some of the things we want you to remember when sending us cases are: your case should be 90 days or more delinquent, a minimum case balance must be $25, a minimum account balance due of $100, it must include your debtor's first and last name, and it must either have a Social Security number or a date of birth or a driver's license number. And please make sure all your addresses are complete. So how does our program work? It starts with sending a series of delinquent notices to your debtors to establish due process. Once we receive your cases, we will validate the information using the National Change of Address database the Department of Motor Vehicles database, and our Social Security number validation process. Once we've gone through those processes, we will create an account and begin the collection cycle. The collection cycle starts with a demand notice. This demand notice gives the opportunity to the debtor to resolve their debt before we start involuntary collection actions, such as a wage garnishment or a bank levy. We implemented something new in February of last year. Quarter debt collections automated the process to issue continued to withhold. These are issued for contractors who receive a 1099 rather than a W-2 at the end of the year. Because contractors can work intermittently, orders will stay in place for a period of 1 year. So when will we return cases to you? We will return cases if we are unable to locate a valid Social Security number or we deem the case to be uncollectible. Once we partner together and begin collecting on your behalf, it is essential that we communicate on balance adjustments to ensure that we collect the correct amount on your behalf. So let's talk about online services. Quarter Debt Collections has self-service options for debtors, and that is available 24 hours a day at ftb.ca.gov. The debtors are able to view their total current balance due, see the balance due summary for each active case. They can view the last 25 payments applied to the balance due. They can make a payment online using a bank account or a credit card. They can apply for an installment agreement. They can skip an installment payment, and they can also delay the due date of their demand letter. So you might be interested about knowing how much we collected for your programs. Last fiscal year, we sent out over 2 million notices and collected $124 million. Okay, so let's talk about our client services program support. We have client service staff here to answer your questions and to provide updates on cases, provide changes to case balances, withdrawals to cases, and answer your questions. And as you see on the slide, the information is there by phone number and email. And at this time, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Kasia Kilgore.
Thank you, Jennifer. Hello, everyone. My name is Kasia Kilgore. I'm the supervisor of the Interagency Intercept Collections Program. Excited to be able to share some information with you today about our program. Over the next 10 to 15 minutes, I will be covering the following information about the Intercept Program. I will go over the background of the program and eligibility criteria. I'll explain how the program works and how your agency is going to participate. I will explain our annual timeline and go over program cost. And then I'll share some statistics and go over the support we provided to our clients. For those of you who are new or just learning about the Intercept program, let me start with a little bit of background and explaining what we do. Our program started 42 years ago in 1975. It is authorized under the government code sections you see here. On behalf of the State Comptroller's Office, we administer the Intercept program that redirects state tax refunds, California state lottery winnings, and unclaimed property funds to pay individuals' debts owed to government agencies and California colleges. Initially, the program was only authorized to intercept state personal income tax refunds. In 1984, the legislature added authority to offset lottery winnings as well. Then in 2009, unclaimed property disbursements were added to the program. In fiscal year 16-17, the Franchise Tax Board's Intercept Program redirected over 920,000 payments and collected over $340 million on behalf of California government agencies and colleges. So how do we differ from other collection services such as the Court Order Debt Program? Here in the Intercept program, we do not make any collection calls, we do not set installment agreements, nor do we issue wage garnishments or bank levies. We also do not file any liens, nor do we report to credit agencies. Our program will only intercept funds that are ready to be paid out from the California state government to your debtors and redirect those funds to your agency. So let's go over program eligibility. To participate, you must be a California state, city, or county agency, or a special district. California state colleges, community college districts, and other post-secondary educational institutions may also participate. State agencies can submit any type of debt owed. Counties and cities can submit debts for property taxes, delinquent fines, bails, vehicle parking penalties, court-ordered payments, and other permitted debts. California colleges can submit debts for delinquent registration, tuition, bad check fees, library fines, federally subsidized student loans, and other permitted debts. Special districts can submit debts in accordance with specified California government code sections. The client is responsible for referring debts that meet the criteria set forth in the government code sections. The intercept collection process is pretty straightforward. You submit your delinquent accounts via secure transmission or SWIFT. SWIFT is the file transfer protocol that the intercept program uses. Participating agencies receive a login for this service once they are signed up for the program. The delinquent accounts referred must meet the following criteria. The debt type must qualify under the intercept program authority, and the state controller's office must have approved it. You must have mailed a pre-intercept notice to your debtors, and the required 30-day response time must have elapsed. The debt amount must be at least $10, and the debtor cannot be in an active bankruptcy. The debts must be submitted with a valid Social Security number, and you should submit one total debt amount for each debtor. Once we receive the file via SWIFT, we ensure that this criteria is met for each record. If a record does not meet the criteria, we reject the account and send that back to you in a report. If the criteria is met, we flag our tax systems with an offset indicator. When it comes to submitting debts to the intercept program, we are aware that many government agencies use private collection firms and data service providers to collect debts on their behalf. These private companies are not eligible to participate. However, they can submit accounts on behalf of participating client agencies. So what happens when an offset takes place? Our program sends you a weekly offset report listing all of the accounts for your agency that received an offset. We also send the debtor a notice of intercepted funds. The following information is provided to the debtor on the notice: their account number with your agency's public contact information, the original payment amount they were expecting to receive, the amount that was offset, the remaining refund or amount or payment amount, and the government code sections authorizing the intercept program. So let's discuss the participation process. Because the Franchise Tax Board administers the intercept program on behalf of the State Controller's Office, you must first obtain approval for participation from the State Controller's Office. The way you do that is to submit the initial request to participate, FTB's form 2282, to the State Controller's Office. This is a one-time process for State Controller to approve your agency and the debt type that you wish to submit to the intercept program. Once your agency is approved by the State Controller, you will work directly through Franchise Tax Board to participate. First, it is critical that you review the annual program participation guide for the current year. This guide provides all the requirements, criteria, and record layouts necessary for effective participation in the program. There are three participation requirements which must be submitted to Franchise Tax Board annually. These forms are the intent to participate, the confidentiality statement, and a copy of your pre-intercept notice. I want to talk a little bit more about the pre-intercept notice. You are required to send the pre-intercept notice that contains specific due process language. Please note, offsetting debtors' tax refunds, lottery winnings, or unclaimed property is a serious and involuntary collection action, so providing due process is critical and required. In the notice, you must provide the government code sections that authorize your agency to submit debts for intercept, and you must allow your debtors 30 days to resolve or dispute the debt before submitting their debt to us. You must also provide contact information for your agency where the debtor can dispute the liability. Franchise Tax Board now requires both new and returning agencies to provide a copy of their pre-intercept notice with the intent to participate and confidentiality statement annually. You can look at our pre-intercept notice sample for suggested language. This is located in our participation guide as well as on our website. Now I'll go over our annual timeline. Any agency can join the Intercept program at any time. However, since we process most state tax refunds during the first 4 months of the calendar year, your agency will benefit most by following our annual timeline. Each yearly process starts in September for the next calendar year's participation period. In September, new agencies submit the initial request to participate to the State Controller's Office. New and returning agencies submit their intent to participate, confidentiality statement, and a copy of their pre-intercept notice to Franchise Tax Board. Also, around September, it's pertinent that agencies mail their pre-intercept notices to debtors. In November, all agencies must submit their annual load file via SWIFT to the Franchise Tax Board. Then in December, we do our part. By mid-December, Franchise Tax Board no longer accepts modification for current year accounts. By the end of December, Franchise Tax Board purges all current year accounts and loads the new files that were submitted in the annual record layout format so we can start collecting in early January. Then in May, the State Controller's Office bills each agency for the prior year's services and offsets.
So, Kasha, I'm going to ask you to hold on just a sec. This is Andy. We seem to have lost the connection. Can you give us half a second to get back on?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks. I just looked up and saw it.
Yeah, sorry about that. We're having connectivity issues. We'll be right with you.
Sure.
Okay, sorry about that, everyone. I think we're back.
Yes, I see it now. Thank you.
Thanks, Kasha. Sorry about that.
No problem. So let's go ahead and move on to the next slide there, Andy, if we can. Perfect. Thank you. So by now you may be asking, what will participation in the Intercept program cost my agency? The State Controller's Office does charge a fee to reimburse the administrative costs of the program. The fee is based on actual costs incurred and varies each year. We post a bulletin on our website annually, which advises of the estimated cost for the upcoming year. For 2017 and for 2018, the fee is approximately $2 per offset that takes place. The State Controller's Office will bill each agency around April or May for each successful offset we collect during the previous calendar year. Agencies do not pay for accounts that were submitted but did not receive an offset. Only if an offset took place will your agency pay the approximate $2 fee. So how much money are we talking about? In fiscal year 16-17, the Intercept program redirected over 960,000 payments valued at $340 million. If you have questions, our contact center is staffed Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Our program staff can answer your questions or provide services and support, including helping your staff answer questions to debtor inquiries, providing copies of missing reports, helping you reconcile your weekly reports and payments, registering you for SWIFT or resetting your SWIFT password, and answering your billing questions. So here you have mine and Jennifer's contact information. Should you be a current participating agency in either program or have interest in either, feel free to give us a phone call or shoot us an email if you have any questions. And that's it for us here at Franchise Tax Board. Thank you again for having us, Andy.
You are very welcome. We are grateful for your contributions. We look forward to more, especially when we meet in May. So we're going to not take a break. I'm just entertaining questions. Please send them to Maria through the chat feature on this WebEx. If you have any questions, we will make sure that Jennifer and Kasia receive them. If we can't get to them today because we don't want to answer without doing additional research, we will get back to you as long as we know who you are and how to get in touch with you. The next feature of today's WebEx will be a review of the trial court revenue distribution guidelines from the State Comptroller's Office. First presenting will be Don Lowry, and then we will have a presentation from the Audit Division of the State Comptroller's Office by Lisa Denise. So, Don, go ahead.
Thank you, Andy, and I want to thank the Judicial Council for inviting us on this ride yet again as we try to keep you up to date on the issues facing trial court revenue distribution from our perspective. As Andy said, my name is Don Lowry. I'm a policy analyst with the Local Government Programs and Services Division, and I will be covering this year's updates to the guidelines. And related topics following me will be Lisa Denise from our Audits Division discussing common audit findings. Before we continue, I just want to remind you again, if you have questions related to audit revenue distribution, either today or in the future, please send it to our unit mailbox at localgovpolicy@sco.ca.gov. That's the best, most efficient way to reach us. As sometimes we do go on vacation or change positions, so using our personal emails may not always be the best. Okay. Today I'll be discussing the changes that took effect this summer due to urgency legislation, the updates that will be appearing in Revision 28 of the Trial Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines due to legislation passed this year. And I'll also be touching briefly on TC31 reports and reminding you, as I like to do, about signing up for notifications of updates via listserv. Now, for those of you who do not already have this bookmarked or even as your homepage, you can reach our page on the State Comptroller's website using the URL shown on your screen. Trial Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines page. It contains not only the current and previous versions of the guidelines themselves, also includes the urgency legislation updates we post as necessary, FAQs, training materials from past training events, and other useful resources. We encourage you all to check it out from time to time and let us know what you like, what you don't like, where we can improve. First, I want to touch on this year's urgency legislation. As with most years, the annual budget trailer bills resulted in a number of changes to the guidelines. Now, we posted an update this summer, but I just want to review with you some of those changes. CCP 384 changed the distribution of unclaimed class action settlements or judgments. In addition to the funding going to community-based or nonprofit organizations, as formerly occurred, 50% of it is now going to two state funds, the Trial Court Improvement and Modernization Fund and the Equal Access Fund of the Judicial Branch. Both of these funds are used to expand access to civil court through various means. Health and Safety Code 103.625 extended the $2 fee for the umbilical cord blood collection fund January 1st, 2023. It was scheduled to expire this January. And finally, perhaps most significantly on this slide, Penal Code 1464 was changed so that the funds collected in the state penalty fund will now be distributed through the Budget Act each year, rather than following the statutory formula, which sent it to nine specific funds. So basically we'll be having to wait until the budget comes out each year to see where that money is going. In addition, this year we had yet another round of updates and modifications to our cannabis laws as the legislature reconciled the provisions of the medical marijuana laws first passed in 2015 with Proposition 64 passed by the voters last November. Essentially what happened is the civil penalties for violations of the cannabis laws were consolidated into a single code section. Names of various funds were changed to reflect the new combined regime. And finally, code references were updated to reflect the current language and statutes. So we encourage you all to make note of those as you are moving forward. In addition to the urgency legislation, a majority of our changes were passed through general legislation. These take effect on January 1st, and they will be included in the forthcoming Revision 28 of the guidelines due to be published shortly after the first of the year. Now, I'm not going to expect you all to read this slide today, but I do want to point out that we had 12 bills passed this year impacting the guidelines. 14 entries in the guidelines were directly affected and either added, amended, or removed. Some of the changes in the law reflected issues on the national scene, such as the conveyance of land from the federal government to either the state or local interest. Immigration was a popular topic, and we also had some hot-button state issues addressed through legislation this year, including affordable housing. We also had extension of the EMAT penalty to January 1st, 2020. As some of you might remember from our May sessions, that was in doubt at the time. And one last thing I want to bring up to you is that Penal Code 1463.23, which authorized the county AIDS education programs and provided that funding, was repealed this year. However, there were several other statutes that refer to that section which were not repealed. So we have provided real guidance on how to distribute those funds if you continue to collect them. Those will be in Revision 28 as well. I want to touch briefly on the TC31 forms. We provide a link to this form at the bottom of our page, as well as the link found on the state accounting page on the State Controller's Office website. This form is updated from time to time as new funds are added or codes are changed, so please check regularly to make sure you have the latest one when you submit your trial court remittances. I want to remind you that the form includes only the most commonly used codes and funding information, but there are lines for adding additional entries. If you need the code numbers for funds that are not listed on the TC31 form, please email Deborah Morden at sco.ca.gov. She'll gladly provide you that information. In fact, Deborah can assist you with most, if not all, of your questions related towards filling out and submitting the TC31 form, so I would encourage you to add her email address to your Outlook, and don't hesitate to contact her when you have any questions. Finally, consider this your regular reminder to sign up for our listserv notification service if you have not already done so. This will keep you updated as we post urgency legislation updates, the new revisions to the guidelines, and other important information on our website. If you sign up at the bottom of our page or using the URL on your screen, you'll receive an automatic notification as those updates are posted. Now, we can't promise you a trip to Tahiti or Insunize or any other gifts like that for signing up, but you will be in the know when changes occur without having to obsessively check our website every 15 minutes. And with that, I'll turn this over to my colleague Lisa Denise to discuss some common audit findings for you.
Thank you, Don. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for listening in today. As Don said, my name is Lisa Denise, and I am an auditor with the State Controller's Office Division of Audit. And I will be briefly going over the audit findings for this presentation. Now, I know you've undoubtedly been waiting for this portion of the presentation, and the good news is we have 8 riveting slides regarding findings, but the bad news is you get a break right after me. So let's get started. On this first slide here, this is the SCO website and where the final court revenue audit reports are posted from fiscal years 2007 through 2017. Sorry. If you wanted to look for your report, you can find it at this website here. Some of the common findings I will be talking about are the emergency medical air transportation EMAP penalties, the distribution of parking surcharges and penalties, equipment and tag violations, and the 50-50 excess of qualified revenues or the MOE calculation. For EMAP penalties, they are being incorrectly distributed in red light violations and traffic violator school violations. For red light violations, the first 30% of the base fine, the state penalty, the state court construction fund, the local additional penalties, and EMAP should go to the city and county general fund. The remaining 70%, after deducting the 2% automation, is deposited by the county treasurer on a pro rata basis. The EMAP penalty should also be included in the 30% allocation. For TBS violations, when the defendant elects to take traffic school, the total bail is converted into a TBS fee. EMAP is not an exception and should still be included in the TBS fee. Failure to correctly distribute the TBS fee leads to findings in the TBS portion of the 50-50 MOE calculation. For parking surcharges and penalties, Vehicle Code Section 40200.4 requires processing agencies to deposit with the county treasurer all sums due to the county from parking violations. The chart below shows the required distribution of those parking revenues. These surcharges and penalties are either not being imposed or collected from some of the parking citation issuing agencies, such as universities, colleges, and cities. Or the required distribution of the $12.50 or $11 per case is not being collected or imposed by the issuing agency. And at the county level, the required $2 is not being included in the 250 MOE calculation. In addition to parking revenues, the equipment tag violations are not being distributed to the state. Vehicle Code Section 40225D allows equipment and registration tag violations to be processed as civil penalties. This is not distributed like the other parking penalties. Including penalties, there is a 50-50 split between the state treasury and the processing agency. For fix-it tickets, which penalties are reduced to $10, they are also included in the 50-50 split between the state and the issuing or processing agency. For the MOE calculation, the chart below shows the 8 specified fines, fees, and forfeitures. After the threshold listed in Government Code Section 77201.1, 50% of the remaining revenue should be remitted to the State Trial Court Improvement and Modernization Fund and 50% to the County General Fund. There are a variety of things that can happen to the 8 specified accounts, but the 2 issues we stated in the above slides are probably the most frequent. When you exclude EMAP from the TBS fee, or when the required $2 for parking is not included, it causes under-remittances to the MOE calculation, which results in monetary findings. If you have any questions related to the trial court revenue distribution, as Don said before, please email the localgovpolicy@sdo.ca.gov. Again, thank you for listening in, and thank you to the Judicial Council for having me here. And if you have any questions, please submit them to the chat.
Well, thanks. Really appreciate having you here. We are now going to take a 5-minute break. I'm going to put our call on mute. Please be back here at 12 minutes to 2, please. We'll see you in about 5 minutes. Thanks. Welcome back to our regularly scheduled program. We just finished the halfway mark in our winter revenue distribution training WebEx. Thank you to the presenters so far and to those of you who have joined. Please remember to send any comments or questions through the WebEx chat feature to Maria. And now I would like to introduce my friend and my colleague, Kim De Silva, who's going to talk to us about the uniform bail and penalty schedules. Take it away, Kim.
Hi. So today I will talk about the uniform bail and penalty schedules, sometimes referred to as the bail schedule. So I might just say that sometimes during this talk. Go ahead, Maria. You can change the slide. So I'm also going to be asking Maria to change the slide, so you can just disregard that. Today I'm going to talk about bail, what bail means in the context of the uniform bail and penalty schedule. It's a little different than what people normally think of bail as. Then we'll talk about I'll describe the different schedules that make up the UBPS. And then I will describe the Judicial Council's role in adopting the schedules and its responsibility to do that. Then we'll go into a little more detail on the traffic infraction schedule. I think of that as a sort of a special schedule because it's the only one that the council is statutorily responsible for adopting, and it's the only one that that the courts have to follow. Then I will describe total bail. It's different than base fines, and it's just good to understand that when you're taking a look at the bail schedule. Then I'll touch on the countywide bail schedules and how the UBPS acts as a guide to courts in developing those. And then we will go into a little more detail on the penalties and fees that are in the bail schedule and that increase the base fines to the total bail. And then I will present you with a list of the specific changes to the 2018 edition. These changes are also available on the JRN, the Judicial Resources Network. There's a highlighted version that highlights just the changes, and so I know that comes in handy to people sometimes when they're updating their case management systems. And then I will just describe some additional resources that are useful. Okay. So go ahead and change the slide. But first, what does bail mean in the context of the uniform bail and penalty schedules? Normally, when people think of bail, they're thinking of the bail that's used to ensure the presence of a defendant before the court. That is not what we talk about when we talk about bail in the context of the UBPS. There are certain offenses where the penalty is just a fine, and that fine or that penalty can be forfeited, and by being forfeited, cancel out the need for any further court proceedings. So when someone pays the total bail for an infraction in the UBPS, they don't have to go to court again. It cancels out the need for any further court proceedings. But also, payment or forfeiture of that bail is treated as a conviction. So it is a conviction. It's just you don't have to go to any further proceedings for that. Okay? Go ahead. Okay. So what makes up the UBPS, or the Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedules? You'll notice it's not the Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedule, it's schedules. So every year the council must establish a mandatory penalty schedule for traffic infractions, but the Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedule also includes suggested base fines for the following schedules: traffic misdemeanors, boating, forestry, fish and game, public utilities, parks and rec, and business licensing. The bail schedule began with just one schedule for traffic, but it has grown over time to include a collection of these eight schedules. Okay. And although the traffic infraction schedule is mandatory on the counties, there are always exceptions to the rule, and these counties make up the exceptions to that rule. So in these 30 counties listed in the PowerPoint, they may exceed the UBPS traffic infraction schedule, so they can have higher baselines than the traffic infraction schedule. Okay. Because vehicle code offenses default to infractions, most of the changes to the UBPS, to the traffic infraction schedule, affect the traffic infraction schedule. So most of the changes every year to the UBPS go into the mandatory schedule, the traffic infraction schedule, because unless the statute says differently, offenses default in the vehicle code to infractions. The council is required, or was required, and did, to classify traffic infractions into four categories grouped by level of severity. And you can see, although it might be a little small, that the different categories from least to most severe are category one, that generally involve pedestrian offenses or vehicle registration and equipment offenses. And they carry a base fine of $25. Then we're getting a little more serious. Category number two are operation of vehicle offenses. So you're actually moving now. These offenses are actually for moving violations, and they're getting more serious. And also size and load offenses. And it carries a base fine because they're a little higher up in the severity scale of $35. Then you go to category number three, and you're really getting into the more serious infractions, such as substance abuse infractions. And these, accordingly, are going to have a higher baseline because they're more of a threat to public safety. So the baseline is going to be $70. Category four is mostly used for proof of correction offenses, and it has a $25 base fine, which isn't really a base fine for the correctable offenses. Once they're corrected, it's just a $25 court fee. So for the corrected offenses, they turn into just that $25 court fee. Okay. So next we go into describing what total bail is. And it's important to understand the concept of total bail in the bail schedule. We'll get sort of under the hood in a few minutes of the bail schedule. But as you can see, you start out with a base fine, let's pick category number one, of $25. But then, and then I'll point this out more clearly in the bail schedule, the penalties and surcharges are added on to that. And then in addition to that, fees are added on. So you end up with a total bail of $196 when you start out with a base fine of $25.
Do you have a question?
I'm sorry?
No.
Hello?
Okay. Anything?
So I'm hearing some chatter on the line. So you can see that that the base fine in the UBPS is a completely different number than the total bail. And then we have examples for all the different traffic infraction categories, category one, category two. You start out with a base fine of $35 and ends up with a total bail of $237. Category three, when you're starting out with a $70 base fine, you're ending up with a total bail of $366. And then again, category four are proof of correction offenses and some others, but it's largely used for proof of correction offenses. And so with that proof of correction, it's just a $25 court fee. And I always, or I go into a little more detail on the traffic infraction schedule because I want folks to remember that that's the important schedule. They're all important, but that's the sort of the special schedule in the sense that it's required, counties are required to follow it unless they're accepted.
Okay. Next. So then this next slide just shows how that same those same calculations break down for the different non-mandatory schedules in the UBPS. And you can see that, again, you're starting out with a base fine. Let's just pick traffic misdemeanors. You start out with a base fine of a suggested base fine of $75, and then adding on the penalties and surcharge and then the fees, you end up with a total bail of $396. And then it's the same formula for all the different schedules. The traffic infraction and then all the non-mandatory schedules as well. It's important to note, though, that the base fines for the or the bail, including the base fines, for the non-mandatory schedules are suggestions because they're not mandatory on the counties. They're provided for guidance for the counties, and they're merely suggestions. Courts do not have to follow those. Okay, next slide. So the council is not the only one who has to publish a bail schedule. Each court must establish its own bail schedules for all bailable felony, misdemeanor, and infraction offenses except for traffic infraction offenses. And the counties are also required by rule to consult the UBPS non-mandatory schedules when developing their own. And in that way, that's how the UBPS acts as a guide to the counties, and that's so it's the suggested base fines for the counties. And then the counties are required to take a look at those and when developing their schedules and then report back to the council where they've made changes or where their fines don't match the those in the schedule. Okay. So I think I just hit on this too. The amounts listed in the non-mandatory schedules are intended to provide guidance to the courts. And that's one of the reasons the council annually updates those schedules. The courts have to update their schedules annually, and the non-mandatory schedules provide them with a little bit of a guidance statewide. So let's see. Okay, next one. So let's take a look inside the actual uniform bail and penalty schedules now. Here we have an example. I just picked a page out of the traffic infraction schedule. Again, I sort of hover around this schedule because it's the mandatory one. And here you can see for yourself, I'm not sure how many of you just automatically have electronic case management systems and how many of you actually look at the paper volume, but some do, some folks do. But this is taking a look at the paper version helps you sort of see what's going on because it breaks down how the base fine turns into the total bail pretty clearly. And you can see there are a number of offenses listed in the rows horizontally. And then you read from left to right. You start out with a base fine of, let's pick the first one in line, failure to furnish name and address to officer upon request. That is a Category 2 offense. And so, as you remember, Category 2 offenses carry a base fine of $35. If you jump all the way to the right, the second to last column, gives you the category as well. I don't know how useful that is to folks, but you can sort of use it as a check to see, okay, well, it's Category 2, so it should be a base fine of $35. Unless there's something special about a specific offense in which the council can increase sometimes the base fine, but there has to be a reason. And then working your way to the right, you have the state penalty assessment. And every time you hear the word penalty assessment, you think it's a function of the base fine. So it's going to vary depending on what the base fine is. So with a base fine of $35, you have a state penalty assessment of $40. With a base fine of $25, you have a penalty assessment of $30. When, if you look at the third line, you'll see failure to maintain registration card with your vehicle has a base fine. There are two of those entries, and one of them has a $25 base fine, and it runs through the formula all the way across. The second one down has a $25 base fine, and then you get a bunch of zeros. That's because it's a correctable offense, and that base fine really ends up just being the a court fee. So then you run through the penalty assessments, the county penalty assessment, the DNA penalty assessment, court penalty assessment, and then you have the surcharge, the EMS penalty assessment, and then the EMAT penalty assessment, which is not a penalty assessment, even though it's called a penalty assessment. It's a flat fee of $4. And then you have surcharge and penalty assessment subtotal next to that. And then you get into the fees, and when you hear fee, you think just it's a flat fine. So you add those on, and then you end up with the total bail. Okay? Okay. So good. So this is a slide of a breakdown of all the different penalty assessments and fines as you go from left to right across the bail schedule. And I won't go in, I won't talk about them all, but I'll go through a few. It's nice to see the formula for the assessments and also where the money goes. It's useful to see. So, for example, the state penalty assessment is derived from Penal Code Section 1464. And the formula for that is it's a $10 assessment for every $10 or part of $10 of the fine. And so for a $25 base fine, you're going to have a $30 penalty assessment because it rounds up. And that money goes to the state penalty fund, which funds law enforcement training and the restitution fund. Then you go into your county penalty assessments, which go into the county treasury, then the county and state DNA penalty assessments, which go into DNA identification, the state surcharge, which is 20% of the base fine, so that's a little bit different, goes into the general fund. And then you have your emergency medical services penalty assessment, goes into county emergency medical services, and then the EMAT, penalty assessment that's not a penalty assessment, it's just a $4 flat fee, so you think of it is a fee, even though it's called a penalty assessment. And that was extended this year. It was scheduled to sunset the first of January 1st of next year, but it was extended, so now it goes for a few more years. Then you have the court ops fee, which goes into court operations, and then criminal conviction assessment, $35. And then if your court has night court, you can add a fee for that. And then if your court has a traffic assistance program, then you can add a fee for that. So those are all the different.
I'm on a student conference call right now. Sorry.
Hi, so a little chatter on the phone. Okay, next slide. So now we get into the specifics, and I don't usually go through these individually, but some people like to take these pages home with them because they give the exact change that was made. And I won't go into all of them, but you'll see all of these specific changes that were made to the 2018 edition are listed here and in the next few pages. there's also a memo on the Judicial Resources Network that has the bail schedule with all the changes highlighted. So that's something new this year, and I am thinking it will help some people. Again, as usual, I talk about the traffic infraction schedule first. And although normally this schedule has the most changes, there is an exception this year. We'll get to it later. What is it? I think it's the fish and game schedule that has the most changes this year, because this year there were quite a bit of recommendations from outside state agencies and for the non-mandatory schedule, so the non-traffic schedules. And that's a nice way for the council to get some subject matter expertise on these non-traffic schedules, because the Traffic Advisory Committee is the one who recommends the UBPS to the council. But for the non-mandatory schedules, it's nice to have the help of some subject matter experts. So you can go down. The second page are the specific changes to the traffic misdemeanor schedule and the business and professions code schedule, which adds some licensing offenses for commercial cannabis sellers, licensees. And that was as a result of Prop 64, and the council got the help of some subject matter experts, the Bureau of Cannabis Control, for that as well. And then Harbors and Navigation Code sections were added. Go ahead, change the slide. You can change the slide. Oh, yeah. And then here it is, the fish and game schedule. This year it's just a weird outlier. It had the most changes because additions were recommended by a state agency, like the Department of Fish and Game. And let's see, next slide. Okay, more of the same. So let's see, are there any slides past that? Yep, I think this is the last one, Public Utilities Code. Okay, any more past this? No, okay. So now we've gotten out of the individual changes, and it's just a reminder to folks that you're going to have to update your case management systems with these changes. And that's it. Let's see. Next slide. And then just some additional resources. You can always find the bail schedules on the public website, the California Courts website. You can also find it on the private courts website, the Judicial Resources Network. The Judicial Resources Network is the one that courts have access to, and that's the one with the highlighted changes. We've tried to clean things up this year so that it's a lot easier for people to find the bail schedules. Even I've had trouble in the past finding them on the website, so hopefully this year is a little better. If you have any questions about the bail schedule, it was posted on last Friday, I believe, and already some questions are coming through, please feel free to either email or call me directly, and I can address any questions or concerns. So now just a little bit about what we covered. Hopefully at this point you understand that the UBPS is a collection of schedules, one mandatory, seven non-mandatory, and that the Judicial Council has the responsibility to update it yearly, and that the traffic infraction schedule is special because it is mandatory upon the counties unless you're specifically accepted. You have a concept of total bail, which again is different from the base fine because of the penalties and fees. And then I touched upon the countywide bail schedules, which the UBPS is intended to act, for which the UBPS is intended to act as a guide. and then we went through the specific penalties and fees, and then the specific changes to the 2018 edition and the some additional resources that people really do use and you should feel free to use. Either give me a call or email me. And unless there are any questions, that's it.
Well, thanks, Kim. Before I go on to talk about legislation, if you want to send a chat, make sure in the send to box you drop down and you send it to Maria, and that way we will receive your question. Let's go on to court-related legislation. What you're going to see here is a link, and the link goes to what should be, on the next slide, this document, court-related legislation. Unfortunately, the 2017 document has not yet been published. We only have a few days left this month. I'm hoping it gets published in 2017. But this is last year's, and it's important to note, we publish this document, we being the Governmental Affairs Office of Judicial Council of California, every year. We do this so that courts and other stakeholders have a sense of the important pieces of legislation that impact court operations. You'll note on the right column, most of the way down, you'll see the traffic category. So that category allows us to identify changes to traffic law, most of which are going to have an impact on the uniform bail and penalty schedule, which likewise will have an impact on distribution. So this is a good resource for you. And when you go to the link, as soon as the 2017 document is ready, the link will take you there. Another thing that I want to share with you is the appendix. This appendix is new and expanded crimes. Now, all crimes have, at least misdemeanors and felonies, all have the potential for both a fine as well as custody time. Infractions only have fines. But anything that has a new or expanded crime, infraction, misdemeanor, or felony, we will be placing it in this appendix. So it's just a resource. We encourage you to take a look at it, and we're hoping that the 2017 version is published in the next few days. What I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about some bills that were passed in the last legislative year that might be of interest to you and will be impacted or will impact the uniform bail and penalty schedule as well as distributions. AB 390, Assemblymember Santiago, authored legislation that changes when a pedestrian may be cited for crossing against a signal. You may have heard about this one on the radio. It did get a little bit of airtime because now a pedestrian can legally enter a crosswalk earlier. The governor decided that that was a reasonable thing to do. We shouldn't be citing pedestrians the minute they step off the curb just because the flashing hand has started. AB 503, Assemblymember Lackey, requires ability to pay determinations for unpaid parking violations. It also places other restrictions on how parking violation amounts may be enforced. And this is a big deal. Up until this point, if you amassed a serious number of parking violations, you were expected to pay them off in full in order to get your car from impound. And now the state will allow you, as of the 1st of January, to request from the local agency where you may have some parking tickets a determination on your ability to pay that could reduce the amount you end up paying. AB 1410 by Assemblymember Wood extends the emergency medical air transportation fee. You've heard us speak about this in a number of contexts. This is the legislation that did so. It extends the date until 2020 for this fee to be in place. Another significant element of this particular piece of legislation is that it expands the use of the money in the fee to include children's health care coverage. In the past, the money was limited to emergency medical air transportation. So this expansion to children's health care coverage is pretty significant. Assembly Bill 1625 by Assemblymember Rubio allows parking at non-functioning meters. And for those of us who like to find non-functioning meters so we can park there, now we can do so and not get a parking ticket. And finally, SB 65 by Senator Hill makes both drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana while driving infractions. And I do want to point out, this is not about driving under the influence, which at a very minimum is a misdemeanor. This is simply drinking alcohol, the charge of drinking alcohol or smoking marijuana while driving. If you are aware of anybody who has ever gotten such a ticket, truth be told, somebody could get both a ticket, a violation for driving while drinking alcohol and being under the influence of alcohol. This makes no changes to under the influence law. This is simply bringing parity between the legalization of recreational marijuana to the legal status of consuming alcohol. So that's it in the legislative universe. I'd like to spend a minute or two talking about some other work that the Judicial Council is doing. In 2014, the Chief Justice of California convened the Commission on the Future of California's Court System as a way to identify what the court system of California should look like in the future. I think many of us who have seen science fiction movies over the years, we have a sense of what the movie world of science fiction, what the future looks like. But the court system and all state government needs to be able to adapt to changing technology and the changing needs of our society. So the Commission on the Future of California's Court System, the Futures Commission, was convened to identify five areas where changes could be made in the law. The five areas that you see on the screen were all dealt with in a report that was submitted to the Chief Justice earlier this year. One of the areas in particular having to do with traffic law, there were a number of recommendations, and you'll see them on the screen here. These four recommendations specifically address how to or how the state might change the way traffic law and infractions are dealt with in the law going forward. Of particular importance is Recommendation 2.4, and the Chief Justice directed a working group and staff of Judicial Council to come up with recommendations to implement a civil model for the adjudication of minor traffic infractions. This working group got started during the summer. The plans for the working group are to continue working through 2018 and into 2019, with the goal of potentially introducing legislation in 2020. It's far too early to say what the outcomes of this working group's efforts will be, but I think it's important to note that moving traffic infractions from a criminal adjudication to a civil adjudication is likely to have a significant impact on the collection and distribution of fines, fees, penalties, and assessments. All things being equal, the money that is collected and distributed, the revenues that you and your colleagues are responsible for distributing, that comes from fines, fees, penalties, and assessments. And the vast majority of that money comes from infractions. So there isn't any hard and fast plan in place. We will certainly keep you updated as the working group continues its efforts, but we wanted to bring it to your attention that the working group, at the direction of the Chief Justice in response to the Futures Commission, is seriously contemplating some important changes with regards to how we treat the fines that come from traffic violations. If you're interested in more information about the work of the Futures Commission, there are two sites you can visit. You can look at the commission online at that first link. And if you're interested in reading the report that was published earlier this year and submitted to the Chief Justice, you can find the full report at the second link on this page. So now I'm going to turn everything over to Maria and Manny, and they're going to talk to you about other collections efforts before we wind up for the day.
Thank you, Andy. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Maria Lita. I am an analyst with the Judicial Council's Funds and Revenues Unit. Again, thank you all for joining us. If you recall, during the summer revenue distribution training, we were in the process of wrapping up the amnesty program. So today I'm going to provide an update of what the final numbers are and the final report that went to the legislature. Also, too, right around that time, there was a few bills that were on the pipeline. AB 103 did pass, and so I'm going to provide some information on that bill and how it may impact the collection and reporting of quarterly debt. Then Manny Mandapet, who is new to the union, will provide an update on the fiscal year 2016-17 statewide collections report that was put together with the information that you all provided to us on the collections reporting template. So effective June 27th, Assembly Bill 103 eliminated the ability of the court to initiate a driver's license suspension or a hold if the defendant fails to pay. The court can still notify the DMV if an individual fails to appear. However, they can no longer notify the DMV for a failure to pay. So it goes without saying that the elimination of this tool from your collections tool that you use will potentially result in additional loss of delinquent revenue collection. Another thing that AB 103 did was that it added Section 68514 to the government code, which requires the Judicial Council to annually report on revenue collections from criminal fines and fees related to infractions and misdemeanors. And that information is due beginning October 1st, 2018. So in terms of the additional reporting that is now going to be required, here's a list of the elements. There's eight of them. For those of you familiar with the collections reporting template, you may have already noticed that some of this information is already captured on that template. The bill didn't change what is currently required to be reported under Penal Code 1463.010, but it did change the level of detail that currently is not required or being reported, such as the currently, you report a non-delinquent amount collected, but now you can see on number one, they were being asked to report the number of cases associated with those collections. So just we wanted to let you know that we are aware that some of these requirements will be difficult, if not impossible, to meet. And so to that end, we have been trying to figure out the extent to which the collections program can comply with the reporting requirement. We are still working out the details. We are contemplating a pilot program and possibly a survey to find out where everyone stands in regard to the reporting requirements, your system's capabilities, what information is available, and how it will be reported. So while more information or guidance, unfortunately, is not available at this time, we wanted to make you aware of the additional reporting requirements and assure you that we will be helping with the implementation process to ensure that we are in full compliance. There's more to come, and we will get that information out to you real soon. For the statewide amnesty program, as I mentioned, when we met last summer, we were in the process of collecting the information from you. There was only a few courts at that time that hadn't submitted the final report. I want to thank you all again for your responsiveness to the many requests for amnesty-related information. At the very end, when we asked for additional data that was outside of statutory requirement, you all submitted the requested information to us promptly. And for that, again, thank you very much. So these are the numbers based on data submitted by the 15 programs at the conclusion of the 18-month program. There was a total of 255,000 cases that were resolved under amnesty, and that resulted in a total of $45.1 million in revenue collected. The total cost to operate the amnesty program totaled $13.5 million, which left $31.5 million in net revenue to be distributed to the respective entities. As for the second component of the amnesty program, which allowed for the release of driver's license holder suspension, the court submitted to the DMV a total of 246,000 notices indicating compliance with amnesty. Keep in mind, though, that that notification alone didn't release the hold for the suspension. The individual actually had to go into the DMV to resolve their matter. To that end, we still don't know how many of the 246,000 notifications resulted in the actual release of a driver's license hold or suspension as a result of the amnesty program. With your help, we were able to submit the final report to the legislature by the August 31st due date as mandated. Andy was the primary author, and she did a wonderful job in summarizing the findings. So when you have a minute, I'd encourage you to read the report. There's a lot of detailed information, great and many great charts in addition to the ones that I'll go over in the next couple of slides. On this slide, you'll see the website where you can locate the report, and it was also included in the email, the confirmation email that was sent to you, the link to the PDF version. This pie chart shows the $13.5 million in program operating cost, which after being deducted from the total, it was collected a total of $31.5 million and remained for distribution to the respective entities. What is not included or shown in this slide is the actual amount that was recovered under Penal Code 1463.007, which 12.6 million and not the 13.5 that you see here. And so what that means is that not all courts and counties were able to fully offset the cost of the program from revenues generated under the amnesty program, but you were able to offset them from all of your other delinquent revenues. So hopefully you your programs were made whole. This chart shows the projections for criminal revenue collected had the amnesty program not been in place. There we go. Okay.
Just, I don't mean to interrupt, Maria, but please don't put your phones on hold when you step away from them because your hold music interrupts our ability to continue with the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. So as I was saying, this chart shows the projections of criminal revenue collections had the amnesty program not been in place in 2015, 16, and 16, 17, as shown here with in the light blue bars. Again, the actual value of collections for those years, which is the red line. So criminal revenue stream collections within the judicial branch have steadily declined at a rate of approximately 3% in five special funds since 2011-12, which clearly shown in this slide. That steep decline that followed coincides with the 18-month amnesty program, as I indicated here in the with the blue bars. And while we cannot attribute the decline in revenue in the revenue completely to amnesty, the drop is concurrent with the start of the amnesty program back in October of 2015. It may be a few years before we know the true impact of the amnesty program on revenues. Now I'm going to turn it over to Manny, who will summarize the report on statewide delinquent quarter debt collections for 16-17. Manny?
Thank you, Maria. Hello, everyone. My name is Manny Mandapat. I'm the new fiscal analyst with Funds and Revenue. First of all, we would like to thank you all for submitting your CRT reports on time. The deadline to submit the annual report to the Judicial Council was moved earlier from December to November. So thank you again for your punctuality. So on the slide, statewide collections for fiscal year 2016-17, there were $592.7 million in delinquent revenue collected, $104.5 million in operating costs recovered, and $10 billion in outstanding delinquent debt. This figure represents a 3.6% increase over the $9.7 billion reported from the last fiscal year. And again, for the full report, if you want to read the full report, the statewide collection of delinquent court-ordered debt for 2016-17, visit the website shown on the slide. This graph is the delinquent revenue collected from fiscal year 2008-09 to 2016-17. On the slide shown, we collected $565.5 million in fiscal year 2008-09, which increased the following fiscal year to $605.4 million. Collections continued to increase, reaching a peak of $710.4 million in 2010-2011. We continued to maintain higher totals through 2015-16. However, we see a decline in 2016-17. This represents a 9.1% decrease in collection from 2015-16. This may be attributed to the amnesty program, but right now it shows we are currently at the same level as 2009-2010. As mentioned by Maria earlier regarding AB 103, and as a reminder for the fiscal year, there will be new reporting requirements. One is that courts will need to start reporting on their non-delinquent court-ordered debt, as well as the number of cases associated with it. Again, if you have any questions, please email it to revenuedistribution@jud.ca.gov. Thank you, everyone. Back to you, Andy.
Thanks very much. Really appreciate it, Manny, and welcome to the team. We're happy to have you.
Thank you.
So I just have a couple of housekeeping items before we call it a day. Again, submit any questions that you have. We would love to try and get answers to you. If not today, we will get somebody to respond to you as soon as possible. Save the dates. Please join us in San Diego or here in Sacramento. On May 3rd, we're going to be in San Diego. On May 15th and again on May 16th, we'll be here in Sacramento. These are our full-day in-person trainings. We'd love to see you and have you, new people who are new to your teams for revenue collections and distributions. Please encourage them to come. And if you've been before, we would really like to have you join us again. Always make sure that if there's something we've left out, something that you want us to cover, information that would help make these trainings better for you, please let us know. That is what we would like. As we normally do, there will be a plenary session in the morning. We'll go over some of the basic information that we touched on today. We'll provide you whatever updates that we can. The breakout sessions in the afternoon will be an opportunity to use the training worksheets that both the Judicial Council and the State Comptroller's Office believe are the best tools to help you make sure that you distribute the funds properly and reduce the number of findings that an auditor might find. But again, please let us know what you want to see, what you want to learn. Send us an email at revenuedistribution@jud.ca.gov. Here's some other links. Most of these were discussed earlier in the presentation, but we just want you to know we do encourage your participation. We want to hear from you, so reach out to the State Comptroller's Office. Get in contact with the court system. If you want more information about the Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedule, I know Kim will be more than happy to answer those questions. And if you're interested in court-related legislation, there's the link. Our mailbox is also available. There's COD client services at ftb.ca.gov, and the IIC group at ftb.ca.gov. Those are the two programs that we talked about earlier. Revenuedistribution@jud.ca.gov. Give Manny and Maria an email, and they will get back to you. And the State Comptroller's Office can be reached at localgovpolicy@sco.ca.gov. We did receive a couple of questions that we're going to have to get back to you. You've stumped us. So since you've included your contact information, somebody will be getting back to you as soon as possible. Again, if you submitted questions on the chat feature, please also submit those questions to the State Comptroller's Office and to the Funds and Revenues Unit box so that we have a full record of them. And with that, I would like to thank you for your time today. We know your time is precious. We are grateful for the tremendous work that you do, and we very much look forward to seeing you in May. Happy holidays, everyone.
The host has left the meeting. So at this time, the meeting will come to an end. Thank you, and goodbye.